Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Suquamakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Suquamak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, everyone knows how to eat. As I like to tell my patients, everyone's addicted to eating. We come back to it every day and we feel better when we do, and worse if we don't. Fasting is great, but there are limits. Not everyone who eats, however, knows where their food comes from, or how it was grown, or who was responsible for being there in the first place. Our guests today are determined to change all that by inviting friends and neighbors and visitors to come and see what they do and what their herd of about 110 healthy cows is capable of doing so that milk and milk products are available far and wide for human consumption. Joy and Kevin DeVos are co-owners and operators of Foxtrot Dairy, a thriving dairy operation just off Highway 97B on the Deep Creek Road, and soon to be a destination for campers and farm lovers to hang out in and see how a dairy farm really works, what the daily routines are, what the animals do, and how much careful and sometimes demanding work it takes to produce healthy milk that could become cheese, yogurt, as well as be the milk you add to your tea and coffee or pour in your cereal. While it can be very challenging at times to run a dairy farm, it can also be very rewarding. Kevin and Joy, welcome to Food Conversations.
Thank you for having us here.
Thank you.
We're delighted to have you here. It's a great pleasure for us. Okay, let's talk about the name. Because, you know, I've never seen a cow and a fox trotting together, but it's kind of cute and your logo is pretty. Whose idea was that?
Well, the terms for the fox comes from our last name, which is the fox in Dutch. And so that's where the fox came from. And then it just seemed fun to make it a fox trot. You know, the dance is kind of a thing. And so we just kind of played off of that.
Well, it looks like the cow and the fox are both having a lot of fun. So I think you picked a good idea. Now, Joy, just talking about four-footed animals, you told me that at one point you watched a couple of young guys looking at a four-footed animal and completely misidentifying him. Tell that story. It's a good story.
Well, we are 4-H leaders, and we were at the Piccadilly Mall, and we set up a station there to let people see a Holstein calf. And we wanted to just showcase agriculture in our area and the 4-H projects that we do. And these two young guys, they must have been in their early 20s, late 20s, not sure. And they walked by and the one guy jabs the other guy and says, "Hey, look at that goat." And I couldn't believe it. And I thought, this is why we need to educate people. This is not a goat. This is like twice the size of an alpine.
So did you have to suppress laughter at that point?
No, I just outright laughed and didn't say anything to them. Like, what am I going to do? You're old enough to know that's not a goat.
Now, Kevin, there's no chance that you would make a mistake like that because you're part of a three-generation farming family, dairy farming family.
Yes.
Your grandparents began the farm in the late 60s, as I recall. What's it like, that history for your own family? It's obviously, you know, father to son and then to grandson. How did that progression go? Was it a natural thing or did it just kind of happen?
Well, my grandfather started dairy farming originally down in Abbotsford, and then they moved the farm up to this area in 69.
Why did they do that? Why did they move it up here?
I think just the opportunity, just, you know, land was probably available.
Right.
And so, yeah, like, you know, for my father, it was pretty natural. He just kept on farming, right? That's what he did, and he kept doing it. For myself, it was a little bit more up and down. There was a period where I actually left the farm. I went and got a degree in engineering before I eventually got married and made the decision to come back onto the farm to raise a family.
When you decided to branch away from the farm, what was going through your mind at that time in your life? Obviously, lots of people on farms do that, but what were you doing in your own thoughts?
Farming is a hard life. and it can be, you make a lot of sacrifices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw what my parents were going through, and at the time I was like, you know, I was young. I didn't want to be
saddled
to a farm. And so I was looking for other opportunities. Yeah, once you're out of that early 20s and you start thinking beyond to a family, then all of a sudden being back on the farm had a different attraction to it.
Yeah, because it's there is a certain kind of place attachment that's part of farming. It's in a place. You don't do it to carry it around in your pack sack. It's right in one place. Now, going from a straightforward farm to a dairy farm that's a place of learning is connected to what you guys were doing with the 4-H. There was this idea of learning and lessons. And so I looked up, of course, 4-H. I want to find out all the things I didn't know about 4-H. For example, the 4-H's. Can you please recite, Joy,
oh
the 4-H's?
Goodness.
No, don't worry. I got them right here because I wouldn't remember them for 5 seconds. Head, heart, hands, and health. And it's interesting. The origins were that some people on farms discovered that kids would innovate before their parents would innovate, and they go back and tell their parents about the innovations, and that would, you know, bring change in the farm. But then it eventually became an organization where experienced farmers taught young people not only just farming, but the values associated with farming. The interesting thing, too, is that it was both boys and girls right from the beginning, almost right from the day one. And so many organizations that we see today are not like that. And now in the States, it's under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And the numbers are pretty impressive. 6 million participants currently and 25 million alumni. What was Joy and Kevin, what was your first involvement with 4-H?
Well, my first involvement was when my children started doing 4-H. Mm. And I was just a parent that came to these meetings. And I started to learn a little bit more. And I had no idea about 4-H. I had never heard of it before until I married Kevin. And he's like, hey, you know, the kids are old enough to be in 4-H. Let's check this out. And it was Lauren Hunter that was the 4-H leader in Deep Creek Dairy when we first started. And after a while, he said, you know, it's time for the reins to be changed. And so there was Bill Kennedy. He took over the club for a couple of years. And then Bill said, hey, you know.
He was the honey guy, wasn't he?
No, he's a dairy farmer.
Okay, sorry.
In Tappan.
Yeah.
And then after that, Bill said, you know, it's time for you to take the reins. Let's go. And so I've been a 4-H leader now for 19 years. And over that time, I've mentored over a couple of hundred kids. And I've had the chance to really see the learning from the ground up. And I learn from the kids.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I'd like to say I just mentor, it's the kids that are teaching us every day and what they do.
It's inevitable. Kevin, you were the draw. Let's do 4-H. Mm-hmm. What about 4-H in your life? What kind of role did it play?
Well, I was in 4-H when I was younger.
What age did you start? I know it goes to start as early, 8 years old or something.
Like yeah, I didn't probably start right away when I was 8. I might have been, I don't know exactly, maybe 10, 12. Yeah.
Really old.
Yeah, I was a couple of years older. And then, so I was already connected to it. And then all my siblings did it as well. Mm-hmm. And so when, you know, being on the farm and my own kids were of that age, where they to do 4-H, that, you know, this is kind of a good thing for them, right? It's much more in depth. It's, you've got the activities, but there's 4-H isn't just about animals.
No.
It's a lot of other things as well.
It's about leadership. It's about values, clearly, about your values as a person and as a citizen and as a farmer, or somebody attached to the land. Are things that might have changed each of you when you became involved in 4-H? I mean, obviously for you, Joy, it was a new thing, and then you were put in the driver's seat. You know, you're going to have to teach this stuff. What did that do for you? in terms of your confidence about farming and stuff like that?
It helped me to become more of a public speaker. My first public speaking opportunity was at a year-end banquet, and I'm looking around and there's all these sponsors, all these parents, all these kids, and suddenly I'm at the front of the room.
And what was that like?
That was so horrible. I can understand how the kids feel when they go to do their public speaking. And for me, now I can stand up in front of a room of people and I can tell them, you know, what I'm thinking. And of course, doing it carefully, right? You can't just blurt out everything. 4-H has been a real changing factor in my life. Yeah. I find that there's passion there for guiding children and watching them develop, like from their first time coming to a meeting to when they're leaving the program and they're able to run the club themselves. And they're able to decide where they're going to college and how they're going to do it. It's not you giving advice, it's them informing you. And I think that's the most valuable thing about 4-H that has helped so many people.
The motto of 4-H is learning by doing. And that seems like a pretty smart thing, because that's how humans always did things. We learned. For you, Kevin, you were growing up in the 4-H world, as it were. Mm-hmm. What about you? Did you eventually have to stand up in front of the group and make a speech?
Well, I mean, speeches are part of the 4-H program. So I would have done it, and then I have had opportunities.
You sound like you're amnesic for something happened. I don't know. It worked out okay, and I didn't get killed.
Well, pretty much, yes. I haven't made it a goal to do public speaking. It's still a very uncomfortable moment for me.
The cows don't respond to a speech. They respond to actions. You're in the right track.
There's a reason why I enjoy being out on my tractor by myself.
I think every farmer's had that thought at one time or another. But 4-H came later to Canada than it was about 10 years or so later to Canada. And it's interesting, they called it the Boys and Girls Clubs originally. That was the original name. And then it became 4-H in, I think, my notes here, 1952. And it's also got public and private involvement. The States, it's run out of the USDA, but in Canada, it's got, you know, farmers and government people and whatever all working together. And it is much broader. It is much broader and about leadership. The pledge, is fascinating. It says, I pledge my head to clearer thinking, my heart to greater loyalty, my hands to larger service, and my health to better living for my club, my community, and my country.
And now it's my world.
And my world. Oh, that's wonderful. This is fantastic. I remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Joy and Kevin DeVos, co-owners and operators of Foxtrot Dairy. Canada's a smaller country, so the numbers in 4-H in Canada are much smaller. There are 8,000 adults and 26,000 members, but that's still a pretty sizable group. Teaching, learning, that's very much part of what goes on in 4-H. What would you say was the relationship between the 4-H experience and then decided that you wanted your farm to be a teaching center? I mean, Kevin, you've been farming as a farmer, and you just described the joy of being on your tractor all by yourself. When you invite the public in, it changes the dynamic a little bit.
Well, yes, we over the years have had many different kids come through our 4-H club, many of them from town with no previous agricultural experience. And just over the years, seeing those kids, they come on, they learn. A few of them have actually moved on to being part of the agricultural industry following their time in our 4-H club. And the chance to teach people that what we do. So we wanted to expand that. We talked about it a long time ago already before we ever officially took over the farm.
Like that story that you're telling, Joy, there are great gaps sometimes in the knowledge base of people about why food is where it is and where it comes from and that kind of thing. That must have been one of the things that stimulated you to say, one of many that stimulated you to say, well, this is time we started teaching other people about it.
Oh, absolutely. When I first married Kevin, I knew nothing about 4-H. I knew nothing about dairy farming. And here I'm now in a role of leading other people.
You thought you were marrying an engineer, turned out to be a farmer in disguise.
I did. And we would have been traveling, and it would have been great to go and do his career ambitions. But being on the farm and being in touch with our roots is really valuable, and having a steady base for the kids to grow up and watching them now stepping into the leadership roles of running the farm, It's actually rewarding.
Aren't there a lot of people living in a bit of a world of illusion about food? They just don't have a clue. Mr. Farmer?
Yes, I guess so, yes. There's many people who, they think their eggs come from the grocery store and their milk comes from
a carton.
Yeah, they don't realize how much work and dedication goes into producing those products for the stores.
When I was a kid, the place that our family, we lived in Lower Mainland, the place where our family would go, and it was the big treat, was to go to the UBC farm to see the cows, to see the chickens. I mean, you didn't know much about it, except that they were astonishing creatures who did things that humans didn't do and that humans couldn't do. And I'm sure you have seen that kind of laying up of kids' eyes when they start to get in touch with animals, other life forms that are quite different from us humans.
Yeah, I'm actually recalling a story of meeting somebody who was a grade 3 teacher in the Lower Mainland. And we were having a discussion about cows and when they started lactating. And she did not realize that a cow needed to get pregnant, just like a human needed to get pregnant before they could actually create milk. And that was eye-opening, that moment there. And that happened 22 and a half years ago. I remember that conversation, and I was blown away.
Yes, it makes us realize that we have many things in common with other living creatures that we don't even realize are part of our... Look, if you think that's strange, when I was in medical school, we had a gynecologist from Panama tell us that you shouldn't get pregnant and have babies and milk and feed them. You should use formula, because formula was way smarter. Now, the essence of a dairy farm, of course, is using a kind of a formula, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But just the idea that that's part of the life cycle is, I don't know. Did you ever have an experience like that, Kevin? Somebody completely out of touch with the biological processes involved with dairy farming?
The whole notion, yes. I've definitely had a lot of people who, especially people that do come on the farm, we've done a lot of school groups over the years as well, and that comment keeps coming out is, I didn't realize this. Oh, I didn't know. And
what about the smells of a farm? Do you get people saying, I didn't know that either. I didn't know that they had some very distinctive aromas.
I think most people are well aware of this farm smell. I mean, I don't think it smells anymore, but, you know, I've gone nose blind.
Yes.
But, yeah, most people, you know, they come to, you know, after a little, it doesn't take very long, and people are fine with it.
They can get used to it. I always think when you drive by the downtown sewage treatment plant, it's a wonderful reminder of us humans that we are biological creatures and we produce waste and excrement and we don't know what to do with it. Whereas on a farm, you know exactly what to do with it. It's got a purpose. Why don't we talk a little bit about the farm, the animals that are the centerpiece for your farm? You pointed out to me, Kevin, that a couple of years ago, you expanded your herd from about 85 to 110, and that was a big step to take. Why don't you describe the life cycle of a cow in a dairy farm? Because that's what you had to do. You used your own calves to expand your herd. So why don't you talk about, you know, what happens after the birth process?
So it takes us about... it takes about 2 years for a cow to reach production age. So the whole process of, so if you're deciding to want to expand your farm, you have to, first you got to breed the animals. You got 9 months of pregnancy. And then you've got about 13 months before that animal is old enough to breed for the first time. And then she has her calf, and then you have a production herd. So if you want to expand, you're looking at about 2 to 3 years of planning ahead of time to reach that your goals. And so when we did decide to grow the herd, it was a, it took us probably, well, I think we were able to do it in a little less than that because we happened to have the extra animals within the system already. But it still took us over a year in order to reach that 10%, 15% growth that we did.
So when the calf is born, what happens then over the next while?
So the first 2 months, I guess, we calves are raised in, I wouldn't call it isolation, but they're limited. The first couple weeks, they are isolated for protection from diseases. Then they are raised in small groups, usually, you know, 2 to 3 calves. That allows, again, to manage diseases and yet begin the socialization program.
Socialization is important.
Yes. Yes, and we've discovered that more and more over the years. research has been done. This is scientific evidence, right, where they've actually studied calves in isolation in groups. And, cows are a social animal. They are a herd animal. So, getting them used to other animals is important. And we've actually observed they learn faster in a group setting.
Sort of model themselves on each other kind of thing?
Yeah, so it goes back and forth. So both animals will learn faster if there's two together than if they're both by themselves. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
good lesson for us humans, huh?
Yep, just like school.
And they're weaned in about, a few days? So it's about 6 days? That's
when 60.
60?
60 days, yes. Okay. 60 to 90 is kind of where we do it.
But from their mother's mother's milk, they're weaned in a shorter
point? Generally, yes, they are removed from their mother's pretty much at birth.
Hmm. I think, Joy, you said it was roughly 6 days.
No, 6 hours.
6 hours, sorry. 6 hours. That is pretty close. And then you have a specially designed formula to feed the calves, which you do that for several months.
Yes, we do feed we call it a milk replacer.
Mm-hmm.
That is done mainly for sanitation purposes. Mm-hmm. It allows us to not spend the thousands or $20,000 it costs to buy a pasteurizer.
I think you can be forgiven for not spending that $20,000. So when they're weaned from the replacer, then they start feeding on, what do they start feeding on?
So the goal is to have them completely on grain and hay by the time they are weaned. So we begin that process.
So it's a gradual process.
It's a gradual process, yes. They get fed. They start getting their grain and hay when they're like 2-3 weeks old.
Mm.
And then as they grow older, their amount of milk that they're being fed stays the same, but they start to slowly eat more and more of the other to supplement their body.
And you're watching them carefully through this time. This is a vulnerable time. They're young, they're growing up. What are the things that you have to be particularly careful about, say?
Basically, the biggest threat is bacteria
mm.
to the calves at this stage. So, you know, scours and pneumonia are probably the two things that you're constantly watching for.
Mm. And are most of those are conditions that prevail, the ones that would make that least likely to happen? I mean, you do things to the way you house them, the way you move them around, that sort of thing, as preventive practices.
Yes. Yeah. So basically everything you do regarding how you manage those calves is to try to prevent that as much as possible.
When we were looking at some of those young animals, they have some little fungus, ringworm.
Ringworm, yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, when they get it, Joy, when they're young, they can become sort of immune to it.
Yes.
Whereas if they get it as adults, it's a much more problematic thing.
Yes, for I would compare it to chicken pox for people. It's ringworm for animals, although we can get ringworm as well.
We do, yeah.
But we don't become immune to it for only just for a short time, and then you can get it again.
Absolutely. It's very popular, very popular in the human community. So you've got two-year-old animals, and then you arrange for them to get pregnant.
Yes, we typically breed them at around 13 to 14 months old.
Oh, okay. Oh, so even younger than that.
Yes. Yeah, they are still basically teenagers at the time.
Well, humans used to get pregnant when they were teenagers as part of, you know, relationship. We delay things more a little bit. We do a little intellectual development. So you've got now, you've through this process, this long-term slowly built up plan, carefully planned process. You've gone from 85 to 110 cows. If you had purchased cows from some other outside source, what would have been the difference? I guess it would be a lot more costly process. What would the difference? Joy, you're the
Well, we don't we've bought animals outside of our herd before, and it has been pricey.
Yeah.
And most of them have not turned out right. So it's easier for us to manage it by growing them on the farm. You know the genetics. You know what to anticipate. When you're bringing in animals that you don't know, you have to work around what they may or may not need.
Remind listeners again that I'm speaking today with Joy and Kevin DeVos, who are co-owners and operators of Foxtrot Dairy. Now, one of the things that really intrigued me when I was first talking with Joy was your waterbed system. And I think listeners need to know what a cow waterbed is all about. First of all, why it's there and how you put one in. So, Mr. DeVos, over to you.
Okay, so, so our cows have a, like you said, a waterbed. It is a rubber mat, or a two-layer rubber mat with, when it's filled up, it's only about 2 to 3 inches thick with water. But this allows when the cows walk in to lay on it, it compresses under their feet, and then they're walking on a solid surface. And then when they lay down, it conforms to their body and completely suspends them, so they're on soft. We switched over to the water beds from what we had before, because it's easy, it's clean, basically, is what it is. Any milk, any urine, any manure that ends up on it, either it's at a slight slope, so it flows off, and we can go with a rubber scraper, and we can scrape all the debris off. And when we made the switch over, we noticed the improvement in our cow health.
What particular things were improved?
On the dairy farm, we monitor what we call somatic cell count. It's a little technical, but it is basically the products that's in the cow's milk to protect them from bacteria. And we test that on our cows routinely, and it tells us how much or little bacteria they are exposed to. And so we can monitor very quickly and easily if changes we make are improving the bacteria quality of the milk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually easier than detecting the bacteria in the milk.
Sure. And Joy, it also makes them more comfortable.
It does. They are much more comfortable. It's easier on their hocks, their back, when they're getting up and down.
Right.
Because it's a lot of work to be a cow.
Well, they're big-bodied creatures.
They are.
There's a large amount of cow in there.
They're very majestic. They're very they're dainty, beautiful. But they're powerhouses, and they make a lot of milk. And when they're working towards calving, we want their joints to be comfortable. So if they're having an easier time with getting up and down and laying and being comfortable, much like us, sleeping on the cement versus sleeping on, you know, a nice mattress, right?
Yeah.
Then we're more comfortable and well-rested.
And it's affected their yield, has it not?
They have. They've increased their milk production since we switched over to the waterbeds.
Yeah. Now, that's an expensive operation, putting this layer, this new technology, if you like, in place. You got some help from, if I'm not mistaken, the Dairy Farm Investment Fund. Describe how their situation affected things for you.
Okay, yeah. So that funding was directly related to the European CETA, the trade deal.
Really?
So that was our part of our compensation for the trade deal, was the investment by the government at the time to...
This was federal government.
This is federal government, yeah. Yes, to improve our competitiveness in light of the trade deal. And so they gave us 50% funding for the cost of this improvement.
And if I recall correctly, you had to pay the money out first and then they reimbursed you.
Yes. Yes, so you did.
I'm just
thinking
of lines of credit and debt and
yes,
all that kind of stuff.
But it was all pre-approved. Like you had to you had to have the whole plan approved before you laid the first nail, sort of thing.
So, Joy, that must have been your forte, dollars and cents, adding things together to make sure that you could actually manage it. It wouldn't be a financial disaster.
Yes, it was quite the planning to make sure that we could actually afford it. And of course, we worked with the vendor and the vendor helped us out. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was Mountain View Electric, where they were helping us out with bringing in all the products that we needed. And they carried out the, with Mountain View, right? Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. We deal with a few vendors.
Yes, I'm sure.
And so they actually helped us with a payment plan so that we were able to mitigate the extreme output of the cost of getting this in. Sure. And then once the project was completed, we were divvied out our 50% of the project. Right. Then we were able to complete our payment with our vendor. But I believe it took about 4 years, Kevin said, for the initial payback for the return on the investment.
The return on the investment means increased productivity with your herd, right?
Yes, the increase in productivity, the increase in, or put it simply, the reduction in vet bills.
Right.
And well, one of the other benefits of it was by putting in these mattresses, as we call them, we could reduce our sawdust use, which is used for bedding for the cows. Mm-hmm. And so that cut our use in half, which is a significant savings
because
a huge cost on the farm.
Margins on farms in general, I've looked at the NFU, the National Farm Union's statistics, and they're kind of horrifying. You know, as production goes up, costs go up, and the gap between costs and earnings is still very narrow, but the volume of costs and earnings is, you're way up, you're on this peak of way up here, and if things go wrong, you fall a long way down. Is that kind of in the back of your mind as the we'll talk about your accountant in a bit, but as somebody with some knowledge of financial management, that kind of thing, is it terrifying at times?
It can be, especially, you know, like 3 years ago, we had a manure pump kick out on us, and then we had it replaced, and not even 24 hours later, a steel rod got into it again, and it had to be completely replaced. And quite an expensive moment. You can't plan for those.
No.
So no matter how much financial management you have, there's always going to be a storm, and you have to learn to adapt.
Always a storm. We'll remember that, the motto for a farmer. Always a storm. Now, Kevin, your herd is Holstein.
Yes.
But you have a few interlopers from Switzerland. Talk about your interlopers.
Yes. Years ago, we just decided on a whim to bring in a few brown Swiss.
On a whim doesn't sound like a phrase a farmer uses very often. What was the whim?
Oh, well.
Color. I want more color.
Yes. Yes. and I got a wife who, you know, likes to do things a little different sometimes.
You described, Joy, that they were fashion models.
They're beautiful. They've got lovely ears. I think it just started out with one of our 4-H members was getting married to a dairy farmer, and for her wedding present, I bought her a heifer. Uh-huh. But there was two heifers there, and I couldn't decide between them because one was quite small and one was quite large. So I thought, oh, I'll just get both of them. And then I let her pick one, and from there, we kept the brown Swiss, and I fell in love with those beautiful deer ears. And then we started collecting or bringing in other interlopers, as you will.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful.
And you have about 6 or 7 now?
No, I think we have like 3, 4.
Well, a little variety is the spice of life, they say. The food for these animals, whether they're from Switzerland or from Germany, I guess. Holstein come from Germany, right? Is that where they come from originally?
Sounds like Netherlands, I believe.
Netherlands, of course. They've got to be Dutch. You grow your own feed, or most of it anyway, not all of it, but most of it, and it's mostly corn and some alfalfa. Is that about, that's what you grow for yourselves?
Yes, primarily, yes.
Yeah. Alfalfa, I remember a long time ago hearing it, the name alfalfa comes from an Arabic word, which means the father of all foods or the food of the gods. What does alfalfa do for your animals, Kevin? What is important about alfalfa?
I think what drives our push for growing alfalfa versus grass is the higher protein content.
Mm-hmm, sure. It's a legume.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's used as a cover crop lots of times and then just mulched in if you can afford to do that because it adds a lot of nitrogen to the soil. That's a very good thing. Now, we've talked about Joy's money background because you grew up in a city, you grew up in Winnipeg, and you did well in school, you said, which I think is probably true. And then you were going to be an accountant.
And then I decided to be a mom for life choices. And I put that on the back burner. And then a few years ago, I decided, you know, I'm going to take one course. And that course started in January. And the lady on the phone said, well, it's lovely that you would like to do that course. Your prerequisite starts today. And I was like, what? I don't need a prerequisite. I just need to take that one course. Mm. Apparently, that's not how college works.
Mm.
And I ended up starting my first day of school with my firstborn son. And we went through school together and took a lot of courses and collaborating and doing homework together. That was very interesting. But I found that I really enjoyed what I was doing. And I just continued one course after the other and until I made my way to getting my business diploma. And I'm quite proud of that.
Mm.
I still question myself, you know, like, why did you challenge all these exams?
There's a good thing to do once in a while, the challenge that's right off the table. What overall would you say about the financial side of farming, dairy farming in particular?
I think for me, I started taking these courses just so that I could understand the concept of payroll, right? Because you have to calculate what you're going to do with paying people. You have to calculate your best return on investments and just in general, keep up with your bills and make sure that everything is in place for the accountant at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Is it challenging to juggle all the unforeseen expenses, for example, and kind of you have to set 5-10% aside for things that you have no idea exactly what they are, but you know there's going to be something like the manure pump. It's not going to be warning you in advance. In 2 years, I'm going to be breaking down. It just breaks down on a given day.
I think working with the line of credit is how we mitigate those challenges.
Yeah.
I think our biggest goal is just to stay in the black.
Yeah.
So if you stay in the black, you have that line of credit to work with. As far as savings on a dairy farm, it's really hard to have that savings component. Yeah. Because there's always an investment that you need to do to improve.
Right.
Like every time a piece of equipment dies, you need to get a new piece of equipment. And there is no stopping that cycle of improving the farm. There's
sure.
always something that's dying on the farm when you're buying something else. And
yes, it might be a machine or it might be an animal. Hopefully it's
yeah.
a machine. You actually worked out how much Kevin is paid according to your cheap labor, Kevin. What was it?
Well, I pay Kevin on a salary.
Yeah.
So his hours depend on the season. So last year, or is it the year before, I figured out Kevin's salary to $12.50 an hour because sometimes he works 90 hours a week.
Mm.
And I know it sounds unreal that somebody could actually do that many hours. But when you're not hiring a lot of employees because you don't have the finances to do that, that's the way it is. You work extra hours.
Yeah. It's interesting because 98 hours a week for physicians, especially when you're beginning your career, can be quite common. But I would say the difference is that the financial situation is much more secure because we get paid for everything we do, whereas a farmer gets paid for some of the things you do, but not everything you do. Kevin, what's the compensation for a low wage, but other things that you have that are part of your life? That, for example, you have the land, your home and your land are the same place.
It's mainly, you know, you've got your lifestyle, you're working usually hand in hand with your wife and your kids now. I know my kids are older, so they're actively working with me.
You got good company.
And so I guess it's that side of it, the fact that it's a family farm is what makes you do the work for less financial gain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there is, you know, when you are working that low, you're not getting it in a salary. But on the flip side of that, there is a certain amount of that money that you're not getting a salary is going back into the farm.
Right.
So you're gaining an asset.
Yep.
So from an economic standpoint, you are still getting ahead, although it really, really can really suck at the time when you want to go out for dinner and you can't afford to.
My parents-in-law were dairy farmers, and the story you're telling is a familiar one. You don't go anywhere. I'll remind listeners again, I'm speaking with Joy and Kevin DeVos, who are co-owners and operators of Foxtrot Dairy. One of the things that you were sharing with me, Joy, was that holidays are different kinds of holidays. You'd briefly been off the continent, but most of the time it was camping. And how close were they to the farm?
Well, usually our camping ventures are always within an hour of the farm because we know the second that we decide that as a family we're going to go camping, something will surely go wrong, and it always does. And Kevin's able to rush back to the farm, or our daughter Nadia is able to rush back to the farm, and that's how we live our lives, with a nice little chain to the barn.
One of the other compensations for being a farmer is that you know what you're doing is beneficial to the world around you. You're preparing, you're growing food for them to consume, that the world is being helped by your work. Kevin, does that, you know, in looking at the three generations of your family, was that something that was kind of an understood thing, that it was, you're doing something that's basically very good for the community?
Yeah, it is. It's not...
You don't think of it every moment?
I don't think of it every moment, no. I mean, you know, especially nowadays, I spend a lot of time thinking, you know, with the climate, that is also going on in my mind all the time.
It's changing things, isn't it?
It's changing things, and also I'm constantly thinking about how I can do this and how I can do it better.
Yeah.
Right? You know, knowing that I am a steward of the land, right? I'm not just, the land isn't just serving me, but I'm serving the land and the cows.
Mm-hmm.
And then in turn, we make food for people.
Yes. And the people, with setting it up as a learning experience, the people who use or consume the food will learn what you're doing, and they'll understand more about why you're doing it. It seems to me that that is a really powerful thing. There's so much of a separation between food production and sourcing and consumption. It's this gigantic gap. I mean, there was a food system that was 5,000 kilometers long for about 50, 60 years, which we're now moving away from and back towards what you guys are doing, bringing people to the place where food begins. And I can only say I think that's an admirable thing. And it's very much a part of this show, which is all about food security and food sovereignty. How do you get food security and food sovereignty? You have food produced close at hand. You get to know your farmer. You get to know the grower. It's a very important thing. Now, you talked about how climate has affected things, and heat was a big issue some years ago, and you had to do some changing with airflow patterns, and you actually lost one of your cows, which was which was Joy was telling me about. It was pretty distressing to see that happen. What kind of changes did you make to help out?
So after the heat dome several years ago, we increased. We installed misters in the barn so the cows can go underneath them and they can get wet and cool down. We had already had some fans in the barn, so we doubled the amount of fans that are in the barn. And all of that, yes, has definitely improved the cow's ability to deal with that extreme heat. Mm. But that's only in the cow side of it. Crops are affected as well. And
so yields were affected?
Yes. Yes, yields were affected as well. 2 years ago, we ended up shutting our irrigation system off in like early August, which is unheard of, right?
Yeah.
We still desperately needed the water at that time, but it was no longer available on the ground.
Quite something. People outside the world of agriculture, people, of course, talk about it. Human health is affected as well. But it is quite astonishing because animals can only adapt so far and then you get into big trouble. Now let's talk about something that is a good factor on the other side of the coin, and that is the supply management system and the stability that it brings to your lives. Joy, looking at the finances of your farm, you, I suspect, can see how the system gives you some longer-term security, some stability to the finances of dairy farming.
Well, the quota system is a really good system. It ensures to the consumer that they're paying stable prices for their products. They're not going up and down like gasoline.
Hmm.
And it also ensures that we know that we're going to get a paycheck. You know, it might not be as big as we would like it to be, but it's coming. And we're able to make our plans based on knowing that our revenues are coming in and knowing how much milk we have to prepare. And so, like Kevin's projection of it takes, you know, 2-3 years to plan increases in your herd. Hmm. It's the same thing with quota. You know quota's coming. You have to start planning for it. It's not something you can just do overnight.
Yeah. What's the unit, Kevin? What's the unit of a quota? How do you get a quota for X number of?
Quota is handed out in kilograms of butter fat.
Hmm.
So we base that off of, well, we're currently, I think our cows are producing 4.4 something percent butter fat.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a simple percentage calculation to convert that over to liters. And yeah, so that's the way quota is handed out.
And the increase in your quota when you went from 85 to 110 animals, what was it from how many kilograms of butter fat to how many, roughly?
I think we increased about 15 kilograms.
Okay, yeah. And what I have is a sense of this process having to be thought through and anticipated, and you sit down and do calculations all over the place about different kinds of costs and changes. And you have to do a lot of the financing for that on your own. You did get a little bit of money from, in addition to money from the when you expanded the quota, from the Shuswap Watershed Council for fencing. And that's not usual, you know, get that kind of help. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was something.
It wasn't a lot of money, but it was something to help us mitigate our footprint on the land.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin mentioning, you know, being a steward and serving the land. We applied for this so that we could bring our fencing back from the creek that runs through our property line so that way we can handle the manure management, handle the cows getting into the creek. The
sure.
old fence was a little too close, and the cows, you know, they like to go for a swim.
They do.
So this is our way of trying to pull it back. So we appreciate that program. And Kevin's almost done the fencing project right now, and then we have to submit our report. Mm-hmm. So programs like that are very valuable to farmers, and I really think that they should be continued.
Sure, absolutely. I think people often fail to understand all the expenses that are involved in farming and the insecurities about it. Now, with the security from a quota system, that has allowed you to think about expanding your operation into agritourism, as it's called. And that's something that you had in December, you had your soft opening, and then in February you had your grand opening of your new addition to what you're doing already. Why don't you just describe roughly, Joy, what is involved in this expanded agritourism?
Well, I started off by, we relocated my husband's shop out of this building, and then we built it, designed it, and made it look like a late 1800s store, or at least that was the goal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the
I was convinced. I thought the wood was old boarding, but no, it was...
Well, it was like, thank you, Shepherd's Hardware, you know. They gave us a decent deal on strapping, and that's what we used, and... Yeah. Kevin stained it with an Andover cream, which we thought was, you know, a heritage classic color. Sure. And of course, Dairy Farm, that worked out really well.
Mm-hmm.
In our store, it doesn't totally look like 1800s because, you know, the freezers and the fridge and the coffee maker and
your
the cash register. Yeah. I mean, they're indicative of 2025,
sure.
But there's no way to really hide that and keep
you
your food
to
stable.
Live entirely in the 18th century.
The plan with the store came from, we needed to serve the campground and we wanted somewhere for the locals and the tourists to come and buy their wares.
Mm-hmm.
And with the store, I tried to focus on having products that are from British Columbia. And this wasn't because of any recent talks in the political world. This was because of COVID. And when the border shut down and you realized, shoot, there's trucks at the border, food is spoiling, and we can't get it. And what are we going to do to look after ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
We're a sovereign nation. We should be able to feed ourselves. And so I started by working with different vendors that are local and, of course, all the way up to 100 Mile House, all the way down to Fort Langley, Surrey, people from Kamloops. And slowly, every week, I'm adding something new.
And plus, you have a picture window into the barn.
Yeah.
Now, that's got to be a deliberate and sensible way to introduce people. They can sit in the store and look out and see what the cows are doing.
Yes, and we have a sheet there with their numbers on it and their names and how old they are and how much milk they make a day on average and how much they've made in their lifetime, how many lactations, and what their current status is. Are they pregnant? Are they bred? Are they open? And that's just to educate people. And I really enjoy it when I see parents bring their child in and their child gets a little snack and a drink and they sit on the bench and then they start asking questions and they're like, wow, look at that cow. Oh my goodness, she just went to the bathroom. Ooh.
Oh my goodness. Yes, of course, we do it in private. Cows do it in public.
Yep.
Yeah. But there's no greater sense of pleasure than seeing a child learn. And even adults, they'll come in and they'll ask questions and we had no idea. Wow, that's so interesting. And they'll ask further questions.
Yes, indeed. Now, we're coming to the end of the show, so I just want to, Kevin, give you the last word about what this change means for you to have the public welcomed into your space.
Yeah, I just hope to be able to educate people and give them the opportunity to appreciate the cows and where their food comes from.
Well, I cannot imagine, from what I've seen of your operation, because I went out there last night to have a look around, I cannot imagine anybody coming away from what you're doing now without a far clearer idea of what happens to get the milk that they drink or use for other dairy products. It's a wonderful thing that you're doing and something that I think is really necessary, as you do, so that people have a real idea what food is all about instead of a kind of wild fantasy that it's in packages in some place. So thank you, Joy and Kevin, for joining us today. It's really been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.